This is Audible.
Hachette Digital presents Use of Weapons by Ian M. Banks, read by Peter Kenny. Use of Weapons follows a distinctive narrative structure, with two different time periods interlaced, a traditional chapter structure, which is referred to as Chapter 1, etc., is intercut with a series of flashbacks which run in reverse numeric order and are referred to as numeral 13, numeral 12, etc. To enjoy the story, simply listen to each audio file in the order they are named. File 1, File 2, and so on. Slight Mechanical Destruction. Zakalwe enfranchised. Those lazy curls of smoke above the city, black wormholes in the air of noontime's bright ground zero. Did they tell you what you wanted to be told? Or rain-skinned on a concrete fastness, fortress island in the flood. You walked amongst the smashed machines and looked through undrugged eyes for engines of another war and an attrition of the soul and the device. With craft and plane and ship and gun and drone and field you played, and wrote an allegory of your regress in other people's tears and blood. The tentative poetics of your rise from a mere and shoddy grace. And those who found you, took, remade you. Hey, my boy, it's you and us knife missiles now, our lunge and speed and bloody secret. The way to a man's heart is through his chest. They thought you were their plaything, savage child, the throwback from way back, expedient because utopia spawns few warriors. But you knew your figure cut a cipher through every crafted plan, and playing our game for real, saw through our plumbing jobs and wayward glands to a meaning of your own in bones. The catchment of these cultured lives was not in flesh, and what we only knew, you felt with all the marrow of your twisted cells. Razd Koduresa Dizet Embles Sma de Marinhide, care of SC, year 115, Earth Khmer calendar. Moraine original, own translation. Unpublished. Prologue. Tell me, what is happiness?
Happiness? Happiness is to wake up on a bright spring morning after an exhausting first night spent with a beautiful, passionate, multi-murderous. Shit, is that all?
In his fingers, the glass lay like something trapped, sweating light. The liquid it contained was the same colour as his eyes and swilled around lethargically in the sunlight under his heavy-lidded gaze. The glinting surface of the drink throwing highlights onto his face like veins of quick gold. He drained the glass, then studied it as the alcohol made its way down his throat. His throat tingled, and it seemed to him that the light tingled in his eyes. He turned the glass over in his hands, moving it carefully and smoothly, seemingly fascinated by the roughness of the ground areas and the silky slickness of the unetched parts. He held it up to the sun, his eyes narrowing. The glass sparkled like 100 tiny rainbows, and minute twists of bubbles in the slender stem glowed golden against the blue sky, spiralling about each other in a fluted double helix. He lowered the glass slowly, and his gaze fell upon the silent city. He squinted out over the roofs and spires and towers, out over the clumps of trees marking the sparse and dusty parks, and out over the distant serrated line of the city walls, to the pale plains and the smoke-blue hills shimmering in the heat haze beyond, beneath a cloudless sky. Without taking his eyes from the view, he suddenly jerked his arm, throwing the glass over his shoulder back into the cool hall, where it vanished into the shadows and shattered.
"You bastard!"
said a voice after a slight pause. The voice sounded both muffled and slurred.
"I thought that was the heavy artillery. I nearly crapped myself. You want to see the place covered with shit? Oh, hell. I've bit the glass, too. I'm bleeding."
There was another pause.
You hear?
The muffled, slurred voice increased a little in volume.
I'm bleeding. You want to see the floor covered with shit and pedigree blood?
There was a scraping, tinkling sound, then silence, then...
You bastard.
The young man on the balcony turned away from the view over the city and walked back inside the hall, only a little unsteadily. The hall was echoing and cool. The floor was mosaic, millennia old, veneered over in more recent times with a transparent, scratch-proof covering to protect the tiny ceramic fragments. In the centre of the hall, there was a massive, elaborately carved banqueting table, surrounded by chairs. Around the walls were scattered smaller tables, more chairs, low chests of drawers, and tall sideboards, all made from the same dark, heavy wood. Some of the walls were painted with fading but still impressive murals, mostly of battlefields. Other walls, painted white, supported huge mandalas of old weapons, hundreds of spears and knives, swords and shields, pikes and maces, bowlers and arrows, all arranged in great whirls of pitted blade, like the shrapnel of impossibly symmetrical explosions. Rusting firearms pointing importantly at each other above blocked-off fireplaces. There were one or two dulled paintings and frayed tapestries on the walls, but vacant spaces for many more. Tall triangular windows of coloured glass threw wedges of light across the mosaic and the wood. The white stone walls rose to red piers at the top, supporting huge black beams of wood that closed over the length of the hall like a giant tent of angular fingers. The young man kicked an antique chair the right way up and collapsed into it. "What pedigree blood," he said. He rested one hand on the surface of the great table and put the other up to and over his scalp as if through thick long hair, though in fact his head was shaved.
"Eh?"
said the voice. It appeared to come from somewhere beneath the great table the young man sat beside. "What aristocratic connections have you ever had, you drunken old bum?" The young man rubbed his eyes with clenched fists, then, with his hands open, massaged the rest of his face. There was a lengthy pause.
"Well, I was once bitten by a princess."
The young man looked up at the hammer-beamed ceiling and snorted. "Insufficient evidence." He got up and went out onto the balcony again. He took a pair of binoculars from the balustrade and looked through them. He tutted, swaying, then retreated to the windows, bracing himself against the frame so that the view steadied. He fiddled with the focus, then shook his head and put the binoculars back on the stonework and crossed his arms, leaning against the wall and gazing out over the city. Baked, brown roofs and rough gable ends like crusts and ends of bread, dust like flour. Then, in an instant, under the impact of remembrance, the shimmering view before him turned grey and then dark, and he recalled other citadels. The doomed tent city in the parade ground below, as the glass in the window shook. The young girl, dead now, curled up in a chair in a tower in the Winter Palace. He shivered despite the heat and shoved the memories away.
"What about you?"
The young man looked back into the hall. "What?
You ever had any, connections with our, betters?"
The young man looked suddenly serious.
"I once..."
he began, then hesitated. "I once knew someone who was nearly a princess, and I carried part of her inside me for a time."
"Say again. You carried
part of her inside me for a time." Pause. Then, politely,
"Wasn't that rather the wrong way round?"
The young man shrugged. "It was an odd sort of relationship." He turned back to the city again, looking for smoke, or people, or animals, or birds, or anything that moved. But the view might as well have been painted on a backdrop. Only the air moved, shimmering the view. He thought about how you could make a backdrop tremble just so to produce the same effect, then abandoned the thought.
"See anything?"
rumbled the voice under the table. The young man said nothing, but rubbed his chest through the shirt and open jacket. It was a general's jacket, though he wasn't a general. He came away from the window again and took up a large pitcher that stood on one of the low tables by the wall. He lifted the pitcher above his head and carefully upended it, his eyes closed, his face raised. There was no water in the pitcher, so nothing happened. The young man sighed, gazed briefly at the painting of a sailing ship on the side of the empty jug, and gently replaced it on the table, exactly where it had been. He shook his head and turned away, striding up to one of the hall's two giant fireplaces. He hauled himself up onto the broad mantelpiece, where he stared intently at one of the ancient weapons mounted on the wall. A huge, wide-mouthed gun, with an ornamental stock and an open firing mechanism. He started trying to prise the blunderbuss away from the stonework, but it was too firmly attached. He gave up after a while and jumped to the floor, staggering a little as he landed.
"See anything?"
said the voice again, hopefully. The young man walked carefully from the fireplace towards one corner of the hall and a long, ornate sideboard. Its top was covered by a profusion of bottles, as was a considerable area of the nearby floor. He searched through the collection of mostly broken, mostly empty bottles until he found one that was intact and full. When he found it, he sat carefully on the floor, broke the bottle open against the leg of a nearby chair, and emptied into his mouth the half of the bottle's contents that hadn't spilled over his clothes or splashed across the mosaic. He coughed and spluttered, put the bottle down, then kicked it away under the sideboard as he got up. He made his way towards another corner of the hall and a tall pile of clothes and guns. He picked up a gun, untangling it from a knot of straps, sleeves, and ammunition belts. He inspected the weapon, then threw it down again. He swept several hundred small empty magazines aside to get at another gun, but then discarded that one too. He picked up two more, checked them, and slung one round his shoulder while placing the other on a rug-covered chest. He went on through the weapons until he had three guns slung about him, and the chest was nearly covered with various bits and pieces of hardware. He swept the gear on the chest into a tough oil-stained bag and dumped that on the floor.
"No," he said.
As he spoke, there was a deep rumble, unlocated and indeterminate, something more in the ground than in the air. The voice under the table muttered something. The young man walked over to the windows, setting the guns down on the floor. He stood there a while looking out.
"Hey," said the voice under the table. "Hell that, will you? I'm under the table."
"What are you doing under the table, Cullis?" said the young man, kneeling to inspect the guns, tapping indicators, twisting dials, altering settings, and squinting down sights.
"Oh, isn't that, you know?"
The young man smiled and crossed to the table. He reached underneath and, with one arm, dragged out a large, red-faced man who wore a field marshal's jacket a size too big for him and who had very short grey hair and only one real eye. The large man was helped up. He stood carefully, then slowly brushed one or two bits of glass off the jacket. He thanked the young man by slowly nodding his head.
"What time is it anyway?" he asked.
"What? You're mumbling."
"Time. What time is it?"
"It's daytime."
"Ha!"
The large man nodded wisely.
"Just as I thought."
Cullis watched the young man go back to the window and the guns, then heaved himself away from the great table. He arrived, eventually, at the table holding the large water pitcher, which was decorated with a painting of an old sailing ship. He lifted the pitcher up, swaying slightly, turned it upside down over his head, blinked his eyes, wiped his face with his hands, and flapped the collar of his jacket.
"Ah," he said, "that's better."
"You're drunk,"
said the young man, without turning away from the guns. The older man considered this.
"You almost managed to make that sound like a criticism," he replied with dignity,
and tapped his false eye and blinked over it a few times. He turned as deliberately as possible and faced the far wall, staring at a mural of a sea battle. He fixed on one particularly large warship portrayed there and seemed to clench his jaw slightly. His head jerked back. There was a tiny cough and a whine that terminated in a miniature explosion. 3 meters away from the warship in the mural, a large floor-standing vase disintegrated in a cloud of dust. The large grey-haired man shook his head sadly and tapped his false eye again.
"Fair enough," he said. "I'm drunk."
The young man stood up, holding the guns he had selected, and turned to look at the older man. "If you had 2 eyes, you'd be seeing double. Here, catch." So saying, he threw a gun towards the older man, who stretched out one hand to catch it, at just the same time as the gun hit the wall behind him and clattered to the floor. Cullis blinked.
"I think," he said, "I would like to go back under the table."
The young man came over, picked up the gun, checked it again, and handed it to the older man, wrapping his large arms around it for him. Then he manoeuvred Cullis over to the pile of weapons and clothes. The older man was taller than the young man, and his good eye, and the false eye, which was in fact a light micro-pistol, stared down at the young man as he pulled a couple of ammunition belts from the floor and slung them over the older man's shoulders. The young man grimaced as Cullis looked at him. He reached up and turned the older man's face away. Then, from a breast pocket in the too-big field marshal's jacket, extracted what looked like, and was, an armoured eye patch. He fitted the strap carefully over the taller man's grey, crew-cut head.
"My God!"
Cullis gasped.
"I've gone blind!"
The young man reached up and adjusted the eye patch. "Your pardon, wrong eye."
"That's better."
The older man drew himself up, taking a deep breath.
"Where are the bastards?"
His voice was still slurred. It made you want to clear your throat. "I can't see them. They're probably still outside. The shower yesterday is keeping the dust down." The young man put another gun into Cullis's arms.
"The bastards!"
"Yes, Cullis." A couple of ammunition boxes were added to the guns cradled in the older man's arms.
"The filthy bastards!"
"That's right, Cullis."
"They're... You know, I could do with a drink."
Cullis swayed. He looked down at the weapons cradled in his arms, apparently trying to puzzle out how they had appeared there. The young man turned round to lift more guns from the pile, but changed his mind when he heard a large, clattering, breaking noise behind him.
"Shit,"
Cullis muttered from the floor. The young man went over to the bottle-strewn sideboard. He loaded up with as many full bottles as he could find and returned to where Cullis was snoring peacefully under a pile of guns, boxes, ammunition belts and the dark, splintered remains of a formal banqueting chair. He cleared the debris off the older man and undid a couple of buttons on the too large field marshal's jacket, then stuffed the bottles inside, between jacket and shirt. Cullis opened his eye and watched this for a moment.
"What time did you say it was?"
He buttoned Cullis's jacket up halfway. "Time to go, I think."
"Fair enough. You know best, Sir Calway."
Cullis closed his eye again. The young man Cullis had called Sir Calway walked quickly to one end of the great table, which was covered by a comparatively clean blanket. A large, impressive gun lay there. He picked it up and returned to the large, unimpressive form snoring on the floor. He took the old man by the collar and backed off towards the door at the end of the hall, dragging Cullis with him. He stopped to pick up the oil-stained bag full of weaponry he'd sorted out earlier, slinging that over one shoulder. He'd dragged Cullis halfway to the door when the older man woke up, and with his one good eye fixed him with an upside-down, bleary stare.
"Hey!"
"What, Cullis?" he grunted, heaving him another couple of metres. Cullis looked round the quiet white hall as it slid past him.
"Still think they'll bombard this place?"
"Mm-hmm." The grey-haired man shook his head.
"Nah,"
he said. He took a deep breath.
"Nah,"
he repeated, shaking his head.
"Never."
"Cue incoming," the young man muttered, glancing around. Nevertheless, the silence continued as they reached the doors and he kicked them open. The stairs that led down to the rear entrance hall and out into the courtyard were of brilliant green marble, edged with agate. He made his way down, armaments and bottles clinking, gun bumping, dragging Cullis down step after step, the big man's heels thumping and scraping as he went. The old man grunted with each step, and once mumbled,
"Not so damn hard, woman."
The young man stopped at that point and looked at the old man, who snored and dribbled saliva from the corner of his mouth. The young man shook his head and continued. On the third landing, he stopped for a drink, allowing Cullis to snore on, then felt sufficiently fortified to continue the descent. He was still licking his lips and had just grabbed Cullis's collar when there came an increasing, deepening whistling noise. He dropped to the floor and hauled Cullis half on top of him. The explosion was close enough to crack the high windows and loosen some plaster, which fell gracefully down through the triangular wedges of sunlight and pattered delicately on the stairs.
"Cullis!"
He grabbed the other man's collar again and leapt backwards down the stairs.
"Cullis!"
he yelled, skidding round the landing, almost falling.
"Cullis, you dozy old prick, wake up!"
Another falling howl split the air. The whole palace shuddered to the detonation, and a window blew in overhead. Plaster and glass showered down the stairwell. Half crouched and still pulling Cullis, he staggered and cursed down another flight of stairs.
"Cullis!"
he roared, tearing past empty alcoves and exquisitely rendered murals in the pastoral style.
"Fuck your geriatric ass, Cullis! Wake up!"
He skidded round another landing, the remaining bottles clanking furiously and the big gun knocking chunks out of decorative panels. The deepening whistle again. He dived as the stairs leapt up at him and glass burst overhead. Everything was white as the dust whirled. He staggered to his feet and saw Cullis sitting upright, scattering plaster shards from his chest and rubbing his good eye. Another explosion rumbling further away. Cullis looked miserable. He waved one hand through the dust.
"This isn't fog, and that wasn't thunder, right?"
"Right!"
he shouted, already leaping downstairs. Cullis coughed and staggered after him. More shells were arriving as he reached the courtyard. One burst to his left as he emerged from the palace. He jumped into the half-track and tried to start it. The shell blew the roof off the royal apartments. Showers of slates and tiles hammered into the courtyard, turning into little dusty clouds in their own tributary explosions. He put one hand over his head and rummaged in the passenger's foot space for a helmet. A large chunk of masonry bounced off the engine cover of the open vehicle, leaving a sizable dent and a cloud of dust.
"Oh, shit,"
he said, finally finding a helmet and jamming it onto his head.
"Filthy bat,"
yelled Cullis, tripping over just before he reached the half-track and tumbling into the dust. He swore, then dragged himself into the machine. Another shell and another ploughed into the apartments to their left. The clouds of dust, kicked up by the bombardment, were drifting across the faces of the buildings. Sunlight sheared a gigantic wedge through the chaos of the courtyard, edging shadow with light.
"I honestly thought they'd go for the Parliament buildings,"
Cullis said mildly, gazing at the burning wreck of a truck on the far side of the courtyard.
"Well, they didn't."
He punched the starter again, shouting at it.
"You were right."
Cullis sighed and looked puzzled.
"What was the bet we had again?" "Who cares?"
he roared, kicking somewhere beneath the dashboard. The half-track's motors stumbled into life. Cullis shook flaked tile from his hair while his comrade strapped on his own helmet and handed a second one to him. Cullis accepted it with relief and began to fan his face with it, patting the area of his chest over his heart as if in encouragement. Then he drew his hand away, staring in disbelief at the warm red liquid on it. The engine died. Cullis heard the other man bellow abuse and slam the starter again. The engine coughed and spluttered to the accompaniment of whistling shells. Cullis looked down to the seat beneath him as more explosions thundered far away in the dust. The half-track shuddered. The seat below Cullis was covered in red.
"Medic!"
he yelled.
"What?"
"Medic!"
Cullis screamed over another explosion, holding his red-stained hand out.
"Sir Calway! I'm hit!"
His good eye was wide with shock. His hand trembled. The young man looked exasperated and slapped Cullis's hand away.
"That's wine, you cretin!"
He lunged forward, hauled a bottle out of the older man's tunic and dropped it in his lap. Cullis looked down, surprised.
"Oh,
he said.
Good.
He peered inside his jacket and carefully extracted a few pieces of broken glass.
Wondered why it was fitting so well,
he mumbled. The engine caught suddenly, roaring like something made furious by the shaking ground and the swirling dust. Explosions in the gardens sent brown sprays of earth and pieces of shattered statuary over the courtyard wall, landing spattering and chunking all around them. He wrestled with the gear lever until the drive engaged and nearly threw him and Cullis out of the half-track as it leapt forward, out of the courtyard and into the dusty road beyond. Seconds later, the major part of the Great Hall collapsed under the combined zeroed-in weight of a dozen or so heavy artillery pieces and smashed down into the courtyard, filling it and the surrounding area with splintered wood and masonry and yet more tumbling clouds of dust. Cullis scratched his head and muttered into the helmet he'd just been sick into.
"The bastards,"
he said.
"That's right, Cullis."
"The filthy bastards."
"Yes, Cullis." The half-track turned a corner and roared away towards the desert. Part 1. The Good Soldier. Chapter 1. She made her way through the turbine hall, surrounded by an ever-changing ring of friends, admirers and animals, nebula to her attractive focus, talking to her guests, giving instructions to her staff, making suggestions, and offering compliments to the many and various entertainers. Music filled the echoing space above the ancient gleaming machines, sitting silently amongst the chattering throng of gaily dressed partygoers. She bowed graciously and smiled to a passing admiral, and twirled a delicate black flower in her hand, putting the bloom to her nose to draw in its heady fragrance. Two of the Hralds at her feet leapt up, yelping, forepaws attempting to find purchase on the smooth lap of her formal gown, their glistening snouts raised to the flower. She bent, tapping both animals gently on the nose with the bloom, making them bounce down to the floor again, sneezing and shaking their heads. The people around her laughed. Stooping, gown belling, she rubbed her hands through the pelt of one of the animals, shaking its big ears, then raised her head to the majordomo as he approached, deferentially threading his way through the crowd around her.
"Yes, Mikril," she said.
"The System Times photographer," the majordomo said quietly. He straightened as she rose until he was looking up at her, his chin level with her bare shoulders.
"Admitting defeat," she grinned.
"I believe so, ma'am. Requesting an audience." She laughed.
"So well put. How many did we get this time?"
The majordomo sidled a little closer, looking nervously at one of the Hralds when it snarled at him.
32 moving picture cameras, ma'am, over 100 still."
She brought her mouth conspiratorially close to the majordomo's ear and said,
"Not counting the ones we found on our guests."
"Quite, ma'am."
"I'll see him? Her?"
"Him, ma'am."
"Him later. Tell him 10 minutes. Remind me in 20. West atrium."
She glanced at the single platinum bracelet she wore. Recognizing her retinue, a tiny projector disguised as an emerald briefly displayed a hollow plan of the old power station in twin cones of light aimed straight at her eyes.
"Certainly, ma'am," Mikril said.
She touched his arm and whispered,
"We're heading over to the Arboretum, all right?"
The majordomo's head barely moved to indicate he had heard. She turned regretfully to the people around her, her hands clasped as though in pleading.
"I'm sorry. Will you all excuse me just a moment?"
She put her head to one side, smiling.
"Hi. Hello. Hi there. How are you?"
They walked quickly through the party, past the grey rainbows of drug streams and the plashing pools of the wine fountains. She led, skirts rustling, while the majordomo struggled to keep up with her long-legged gait. She waved to those who greeted her, government ministers and their shadows, foreign dignitaries and attachés, media stars of all persuasions, revolutionaries and navy brass, the captains of industry and commerce and their more extravagantly wealthy shareholders. The Hralses snapped perfunctorily at the heels of the majordomo, their claws skittering on the polished mica floor, all ungainly, then bounding forward when they encountered one of the many priceless rugs scattered throughout the turbine hall. At the steps to the Arboretum, hidden from the main hall by the easternmost dynamo housing, she paused, thanked the majordomo, shooed the Hralses away, patted her perfect hair, smoothed her already immaculately smooth gown, and checked that the single white stone on the black choker was centred, which it was. She started down the steps towards the tall doors of the Arboretum. One of the Heralses whined from the top of the steps, bouncing up and down on its forelegs, eyes watering. She looked back, annoyed.
Quiet, Bouncer. Away.
The animal lowered its head and snuffled off. She closed the double doors quietly behind her, taking in the quiet extent of luxuriant foliage the Arboretum presented. Outside the high crystal curve of the partial dome, the night was black. Small, sharp lights burned on tall masts inside the Arboretum, casting deep, jagged shadows amongst the crowded plants. The air was warm and smelled of earth and sap. She breathed deeply and walked towards the far side of the enclosure.
Hello there.
The man turned quickly to find her standing behind him, leaning against a light mast, her arms crossed, a small smile on her lips and in her eyes. Her hair was blue-black, like her eyes. Her skin was fawn, and she looked slimmer than she did on newscasts, when, for all her height, she could seem stocky. He was tall and very slim, and unfashionably pale, and most people would have thought his eyes were too close together. He looked at the delicately patterned leaf he still held in one fragile-looking hand, then let it go, smiling uncertainly, and stepped out of the extravagantly flowered bush he'd been investigating. He rubbed his hands, looked bashful.
I'm sorry, I...
he gestured nervously.
That's all right, she said, reaching out.
They clasped hands.
You're Relstock Susepin, aren't you?
Yes, he said, obviously surprised. He was still holding her hand. He realised this and looked even more discomforted, quickly letting go.
Dizziat Smar.
She bowed her head a little, very slowly, letting her shoulder-length hair swing, keeping her eyes on him.
Yes, I know, of course. Pleased to meet you.
Good, she nodded.
And are you? I've heard your work.
Oh! He looked boyishly pleased and clapped his hands in a gesture he didn't seem to notice himself making.
Oh, that's very...
I didn't say that I liked it, she said, the smile hovering only on one side of her mouth now.
Ah,
crestfallen. So cruel.
But I do like it very much, she said.
And suddenly she was communicating amused, even conspiratorial, contrition through her expression. He laughed, and she felt something relax inside her. This was going to be all right.
I did wonder why I'd been invited, he confessed,
the deep-set eyes somehow bright.
Everybody here seems so...
he shrugged.
Important. That's why I...
he waved awkwardly behind him at the plant he'd been inspecting.
You don't think composers should be regarded as important?
She asked, gently chiding.
Well, compared to all these politicians and admirals and business people, in terms of power, I mean... and I'm not even a very well-known musician. I'd have thought Savantrig or Coup or...
They've composed their careers very well, certainly, she agreed. He paused for a moment, then gave a small laugh and looked down. His hair was very fine and glinted in the high mast light. It was her turn to fall in with his laugh. Maybe she ought to mention the commission now, rather than leaving it to the next meeting, when she would reduce the numbers, even if they were distant numbers at the moment, to something a little more friendly, or even leaving it to a private rendezvous later still, once she was sure he had been captivated. How long should she spin this out? He was what she wanted, but it would mean so much more after a charged friendship. That long, exquisite exchange of gradually more intimate confidences, the slow accumulation of shared experiences, the languorous, spiralling dance of attraction, coming and going and coming and going, winding closer and closer, until that laziness was sublimed in the engulfing heat of consummation. He looked her in the eyes and said,
"You flatter me, Miss Smar."
She returned his gaze, raising her chin a little, acutely aware of each nuance in her carefully translated body language. There was an expression on his face she did not think so childish now. His eyes reminded her of the stone on her bracelet, She felt a little light-headed and took a deep breath.
Ahem.
She froze. The word had been pronounced from behind and to one side of her. She saw Suseppin's gaze falter and shift. Smar kept her expression serene as she turned, then glared at the grey-white casing of the drone as though attempting to melt holes in it.
What?
She said, in a voice that might have etched steel. The drone was the size, and near enough the shape, of a small suitcase. It floated in towards her face.
Trouble, Toots,
it said, then moved briskly to one side, angling its body so that it appeared to be contemplating the inky heights of sky beyond the crystal semisphere. Smar looked down at the brick floor of the arboretum. Her lips pursed. She allowed herself the tiniest of shakes of the head.
Mr. Suseppin,
she smiled and spread her hands.
This pains me, but will you?
Of course.
He was already moving and went quickly past, nodding once.
Perhaps we can talk later, she said.
He turned, still backing off.
Yes, I'd... Well, that would...
He seemed to lose inspiration and nodded nervously again, walking quickly to the doors at the far end of the arboretum. He left without looking back. Smar whirled round to the drone, which was now humming innocently and apparently staring into the depths of a gaudily coloured flower, its stubby snout half buried in the bloom. It noticed her and looked up. She stood with legs apart, put one fist on her hip and said,
Toots?
The drone's aura field flashed on, the mixture of purple regret and gunmetal puzzlement looking distinctly unconvincing.
I don't know, Smar. Just slipped out. Alliteration.
Smar kicked at a dead branch, fixed the drone with a glare and said,
Well?
You're not going to like this,
the drone said quietly, retreating a little and going dark with sorrow. Smar hesitated. She looked away for a moment, shoulders suddenly slumping. She sat down on one of the tree roots, the gown crumpled around her.
It's Zakalwe, isn't it?
The drone flashed rainbow in surprise, so quickly she thought it might even have been genuine.
Good grief, it said. How?
She waved the question away. I don't know. Tone of voice? Human intuition? Just that time again. Life was getting to be too much fun. She closed her eyes and rested her head against the rough dark trunk of the tree.
So?
The drone, Scaffin Amtiscor, lowered itself to the same height as the woman's shoulder and floated near her. She looked at it.
We need him back again, it told her.
I sort of thought so,
Smar sighed, flicking away an insect which had just landed on her shoulder.
Well, yes, I'm afraid nothing else will work. It has to be him personally.
Yeah, but does it have to be me personally?
That's the consensus.
Wonderful, Smar said sourly.
You want the rest?
Does it get any better?
Not really.
Hell!
Smar clapped her hands on her lap and rubbed them up and down.
Might as well have it all at once.
You would have to leave tomorrow.
Oh, drone, come on!
She buried her head in her hands. She looked up. The drone was fiddling with a twig.
You're kidding.
Afraid not.
What about all this?
She waved towards the turbine hall doors.
What about the peace conference? What about all the froth out there with their greased-up palms and their beady eyes? What about 3 years' work? What about an entire fucking planet?
The conference will go ahead.
Oh, sure. But what about this pivotal role I was supposed to be playing?
Ah,
said the drone, bringing the twig right up to the sensing band on the front of its casing.
Well,
oh, no.
Look, I know you don't like...
No, drone. It's not...
Smar got up suddenly and went to the edge of the crystal wall, looking out into the night.
Dizzy,
the drone said, drifting closer.
Don't you dizzy me.
Smar, it isn't real. It's a stand-in. Electronic, mechanical, electrochemical, chemical, a machine. A mind-controlled machine, not alive in itself, not a clone, or...
I know what it is, drone, she said,
clasping her hands behind her. The drone floated closer to her, putting its feels to her shoulders, squeezing gently. She shook its grip off, looked down.
We need your permission, Dizziard.
Yeah, I know that too. She looked up for stars that were twice hidden by cloud and by the lights of the arboretum.
You can, of course, stay here if you want to.
The drone's voice was heavy, remorseful.
The peace conference is certainly important. It needs somebody to smooth things through, no doubt about that.
And what's so goddamn crucial, I have to hightail it tomorrow.
Remember Vorenhutz?
I remember Vorenhutz, she said, voice flat.
Well, the peace lasted 40 years, but it's breaking down now. Zakalwe worked with a man called
Mechai?
She frowned, half turning her head to the drone. Beishai. Soldrin Beishai. He became president of the cluster following our involvement. While he was in power, he held the political system together, but he retired 8 years ago, long before he had to pursue a life of study and contemplation.
The drone made a sighing noise.
Things have slipped back since, and at the moment, Beishai lives on a planet whose leaders are subtly hostile to the forces Zakalwe and Beishai represented and we backed, and who are taking a leading part in the factionalizing of the group. There are several small conflicts underway, and many more brewing. Full-scale war involving the entire cluster is, as they say, imminent.
And Zakalwe?
Basically, it's an out. Down to the planet, convince Beishai he's needed, and at the very least, get him to declare an interest. But it may mean a physical spring, and the added complication is Beishai may require a lot of convincing.
Smar thought it through, still regarding the night.
No tricks we can play?
The two men know each other too well for anything other than the real Zakalwe to work. Likewise, Soldrin Beishai and the political machine throughout the entire system. Too many memories involved altogether.
Yeah, Smar said quietly. Too many memories.
She rubbed her bare shoulders as though she was cold.
What about big guns?
We've a nebula fleet assembling, a core of one limited system vehicle, and 3 general contact units stationed around the cluster itself, plus 80 or so GCUs keeping their tracks within a month's rush-in distance. There ought to be 4 or 5 GSVs within a 2 to 3 month dash for the next year or so, but that's very, very much a last resort.
Megadeth figures looking a bit equivocal, are they?
Smar sounded bitter.
If you want to put it that way,
Scaffin Amptiscore said.
Oh, goddamn,
Smar said quietly, closing her eyes.
So, how far away is Vorenhutz? I've forgotten.
Only about 40 days, but we have to pick Zakalwe up first. Say, 90 for the whole outward journey?
She turned around.
Who's going to control the stand-in if the ship's taking me?
Her gaze flicked skyward.
The just testing will remain here in any event, the drone said. The very fast picket xenophobe has been put at your disposal. It can uplift tomorrow, a little after noon, earliest, should you wish.
Smar stood still for a moment, feet together and arms crossed, her lips pursed and face pinched. Scaffin Amptiscore introspected for a moment and decided it felt sorry for her. The woman was immobile and silent for a few seconds. Then, abruptly, she was striding towards the turbine hall doors, heels clattering on the brick pathway. The drone swooped after her, falling in at her shoulder.
What I wish, Smar said, is that you had a better sense of timing.
I'm sorry. Did I interrupt something?
Not at all. And what the hell's a very fast picket, anyway?
New name for a demilitarized rapid offensive unit, the drone said.
She glanced at it. It wobbled, shrugging.
It's supposed to sound better.
And it's called the xenophobe? Well, that's just fine. Can the stand-in pick up immediately?
Noon tomorrow. Can you debrief up to
tomorrow morning?
Smar said, as the drone flicked round in front of her and sucked the tall doors open. She strode through and leapt up the steps into the turbine hall, skirts gathered in front of her. The Heralders came skidding round the corner from the hall and gathered yelping and bouncing around her. Smar stopped while they milled around her, sniffing her hems and trying to lick her hands.
No, she told the drone. On second thoughts, scan me tonight, when I tell you. I'll get rid of this lot early if I can. I'm going to find Ambassador Onitnert now. Have Makril tell Chusley she's to get the minister over to the bar at Turbine 1 in 10 minutes. Make my apologies to the System Times hacks. Have them taken back to the city and released. Give them a bottle of Nightfall each. Cancel the photographer. Give him one still camera and let him take 64 snaps, strictly full permission required. Have one of the male staff find Relstock Sepin and invite him to my apartments in 2 hours. Oh, and Smar broke off suddenly and went down on her haunches to cradle the long snout of one of the whimpering heralds in her hands. "Gainly, Gainly, I know," she said, as the big-bellied animal keened and licked at her face. "I wanted to be here to see your babies born, but I can't." She sighed, hugged the beast, then held its chin in one hand. "What am I to do, Gainly? I could have you put to sleep until I come back, and you'd never know. But all your friends would miss you."
"Have them all put to sleep," the drone suggested.
Smar shook her head. "You take care of them till I get back," she told the other heralds. "All right?" She kissed the animal's nose and got up. Gainly sneezed. "Two other things, drone," Smar said, walking through the excited pack.
"What?"
"Don't call me Toots again. All right?"
"All right. What else?"
They rounded the gleaming bulk of the long-stilled number 6 turbine, and Smar stopped for a moment, surveying the busy crowd in front of her, taking a deep breath and straightening her shoulders. She was already smiling as she started forward and said quietly to the drone,
"I don't want the stand-in screwing anybody." "Okay," the drone said, as they went towards the partying people. "It is, after all, in a sense, your body."
"That's just it, drone," Smar said, nodding to a waiter who scurried forward, drinks tray proffered. "It isn't my body." Aircraft and ground vehicles floated and wound away from the old power station. The important people had departed. There were a few stragglers left in the hall, but they didn't need her. She felt weary and glanded a little snap to lift the mood. From the south balcony of the apartments, fashioned from the station's admin block, she looked down to the deep valley in the line of taillights strung out along Riverside Drive. An aircraft whistled overhead, banking and disappearing over the tall, curved lip of the old dam. She watched the plane go, then turned towards the penthouse doors, taking off the small formal jacket and slinging it over her shoulder. Music was playing, deep inside the sumptuous suite beneath the roof garden. She headed instead for the study, where Scaffin Amtiscor was waiting. The scan to update the stand-in took only a couple of minutes. She came round with the usual feeling of dislocation, but it passed quickly enough. She kicked off her shoes and padded through the soft, dark corridors towards the music. Relstock Sepin drew himself out of the seat he'd been occupying, still holding a softly glowing glass of Nightfall. Smar stopped in the doorway.
"Thank you for staying," she said,
dropping the little jacket onto a couch.
"That's all right?"
He brought the glass of glowing drink towards his lips, then seemed to think the better of it, and cradled it in both hands instead.
"What, was there anything in particular you..."
Smar smiled, somehow sadly, and put both hands on the wings of a big revolving chair which she stood behind. She looked down at the hide cushion.
"Perhaps now I'm flattering myself," she said. "But, not to put too fine a point on it."
She looked up at him.
"Would you like to fuck?"
Relstock Sepin stood stock still. After a while, he raised the glass to his lips and took a long, slow drink, then brought the glass slowly back down again.
"Yes," he said. "Yes, I wanted to, instantly." "There's only tonight," she said,
holding up one hand.
"Just tonight. It's difficult to explain, but from tomorrow onwards, for maybe half a year or more, I'm going to be incredibly busy. Two places at once sort of busy, you know?"
He shrugged.
"Sure, anything you say."
Smar relaxed then, and a smile grew gradually on her face. She pushed the big chair round and slid the bracelet from her wrist to let it fall into the seat. Then she gently unbuttoned the top of her gown and stood there. Sepin drained his glass, placed it on a shelf, and walked towards her.
Lights, she whispered.
The lights slowly dimmed, right down, until eventually the softly glowing dregs of the finished drink made the glass on the shelf the brightest thing in the room.
Numeral 13.
Wake up!
He woke up. Dark. He straightened beneath the covers, wondering who had talked to him like that. Nobody talked to him in that tone, not anymore. Even half asleep, coming unexpectedly awake in what must be the middle of the night, he heard something in that tone he hadn't heard for 2, maybe 3 decades. Impertinence. Lack of respect. He brought his head out of the sheltering cover into the warm air of the room and looked round in the one light gloom to see who had dared address him like that. An instant of fear, had somebody got past the guards and security screens, was replaced by a furious hunger to see who had the effrontery to speak like that to him. The intruder sat in a chair just beyond the end of the bed. He looked odd in a way which was itself odd, a very new sort of unusualness, unplaceable, even alien. He gave the impression of being a slightly skewed projection. The clothes looked strange too. Baggy, brightly coloured, even in the dim light of the bedside lamp. The man was dressed like a clown or a jester, but his somehow too symmetrical face looked grim? Contemptuous? That foreignness made it difficult to tell. He started to grope for his glasses, but it was just sleep in his eyes. The surgeons had given him new eyes 5 years ago, but 60 years of short-sightedness had left him with an ingrained reaction to reach for glasses which were not there whenever he first woke up. A small price to pay, he had always thought, and now, with a new retro-aging treatment. The sleep cleared from his eyes. He sat up, looking at the man in the chair, and began to think he was having a dream or seeing a ghost. The man looked young. He had a broad, tanned face and black hair tied back behind his head, but thoughts of spirits and the dead came into his head not because of that. It was something about the dark, pit-like eyes and the alien set of that face.
Good evening, Ethnarch.
The young man's voice was slow and measured. It sounded somehow like the voice of someone much older. Old enough to make the Ethnarch feel suddenly young in comparison. It chilled him. He looked around the room. Who was this man? How had he got in here? The palace was meant to be impregnable. There were guards everywhere. What was going on? The fear came back. The girl from the previous evening lay still on the far side of the wide bed, just a lump under the covers. A couple of dormant screens on the wall to the Ethnarch's left reflected the bedside light's weak glow. He was frightened, but fully awake now and thinking quickly. There was a gun concealed in the bed's headboard. The man at the end of the bed didn't seem to be armed, but then why was he here? But the gun represented a desperate last resort. The voice code was the thing. The mics and cameras in the room were on standby, their automatic circuits waiting for a specific sentence to activate them. Sometimes he wanted privacy in here. Other times he wanted to record something only for himself. And of course, he'd always known there was a possibility that somebody unauthorized might get in here, no matter how tight the security was. He cleared his throat.
Well, well, this is a surprise.
His voice was even. He sounded calm. He smiled thinly, pleased with himself. His heart, the heart of an athletic young anarchist woman up until 11 years ago, was beating quickly, but not worryingly so. He nodded.
This is a surprise, he repeated.
There, it was done. An alarm would already be ringing in the basement control room. The guards would come piling through the door in a few seconds. Or they might not risk that and instead release the ceiling gas cylinders, blasting them both into unconsciousness in a blinding fog. There was a danger that would rupture his eardrums, he thought, swallowing. But he could always take a new pair from a healthy dissident. Maybe he wouldn't even have to do that. The rumour was that the retro-aging might include the possibility of body parts regrowing. Well, nothing wrong with strength in depth, backups. He liked the feeling of security that gave one.
Well, well, he
heard himself say, just in case the circuits hadn't picked up the code first or second time round.
This is indeed a surprise.
The guards should be here any second. The brightly dressed young man smiled. He flexed oddly and leant forward until his elbows rested on the top of the bed's ornate footboard. His lips moved to produce what might have been a smile. He reached into one pocket of the baggy pantaloons and produced a small black gun. He pointed it straight at the ethnarch and said,
"Your code won't work, Ethnarch Kerian. There won't be any more surprises that you're expecting, and I'm not. The basement security center is as dead as everything else."
The ethnarch Kerian stared at the little gun. He'd seen water pistols that looked more impressive.
What is going on? Can he really have come to kill me?
The man certainly didn't dress like an assassin, and surely any serious assassin would just have killed him in his sleep. The longer this fellow sat here, talking, the more danger he was in, whether he had knocked out the links to the security center or not. So he might be mad, but he probably wasn't an assassin. It was simply ludicrous that a real professional assassin would behave like this, and only an extremely able and completely professional assassin could have penetrated the palace security. Thus, the ethnarch Kerian tried to convince his suddenly wildly beating mutinous heart, where were the damn guards? He thought again about the gun hidden in the ornamental headboard behind him. The young man folded his arms so that the little gun was no longer pointing at the ethnarch.
Mind if I tell you a little story? He must be mad.
No, no, why don't you tell me a story?
The ethnarch said, in his most friendly and avuncular voice.
What's your name, by the way? You appear to have the advantage over me.
Yes, I do, don't I?
The old voice from the young lips said.
Actually, there are two stories, but you know most of one of them. I'll tell them at the same time. See if you can tell which is which.
Shh,
the man said, putting the little gun to his lips. The ethnarch half glanced at the girl on the other side of the bed. He realized he and the intruder had been talking in quite low tones. Maybe if he could get the girl to wake, she might draw his fire, or at least distract him, while he grabbed for the gun in the headboard. He was faster than he had been for 20 years, thanks to the new treatment. Where the hell were those guards?
Now look here, young man, he roared. I just want to know what you think you're doing here, eh?
His voice, a voice that had filled halls and squares with that amplification, echoed through the room. Damn it! The guards in the basement security center ought to be able to hear it without any microphones. The girl on the other side of the bed didn't even stir. The young man was smirking.
They're all asleep, ethnarch. There's just you and me. Now, this story...
What?
The ethnarch Kerian gulped, drawing his legs up under the covers.
What are you here for?
The intruder looked mildly surprised.
Oh, I'm here to take you out, ethnarch. You are going to be removed. Now.
He laid the gun on the broad top of the bed footboard. The ethnarch stared at it. It was too far away for him to grab, but...
The story, the intruder said, settling back in the chair. Once upon a time, over the gravity well and far away, there was a magical land where they had no kings, no laws, no money, and no property, but where everybody lived like a prince, was very well behaved, and lacked for nothing. And these people lived in peace. But they were bored, because paradise can get that way after a time, and so they started to carry out missions of good works. Charitable visits upon the less well-off, you might say. And they always tried to bring with them the thing that they saw as the most precious gift of all. Knowledge. Information. And as wide a spread of that information as possible. Because these people were strange, in that they despised rank, and hated kings, and all things hierarchic. Even ethnarchs.
The young man smiled thinly. So did the ethnarch. He wiped his brow and shifted back a little in the bed, as though getting more comfortable, heart still pounding.
Well, for a time, a terrible force threatened to take away their good works. But they resisted it, and they won, and came out of the conflict stronger than before. And if they had not been so unconcerned with power for its own sake, they would have been terribly feared. But as it was, they were only slightly feared, just as a matter of course, given the scale of their power. And one of the ways it amused them to wield that power was to interfere in societies they thought might benefit from the experience. And one of the most efficient ways of doing that in a lot of societies is to get to the people at the top. Many of their people become physicians to great leaders, and with medicines and treatments that seem like magic to the comparatively primitive people they're dealing with, ensure that a great and good leader has a better chance of surviving. That's the way they prefer to work, offering life, you see, rather than dealing death. You might call them soft, because they're very reluctant to kill, and they might agree with you. But they're soft the way the ocean is soft. And, well, ask any sea captain how harmless and puny the ocean can be.
Yes, I see, the ethnarch said,
sitting back a little further, shifting a pillow into place behind his back, and checking just where he was in relation to the section of headboard that concealed the gun. His heart was thrashing in his chest.
Another thing they do, these people, another way they deal in life rather than death, is they offer leaders of certain societies below a certain technological level the one thing all the wealth and power those leaders command cannot buy them. A cure for death. A return to youth.
The ethnarch stared at the young man, suddenly more intrigued than terrified. Did he mean the retro-aging?
Ah, it's starting to click into place now, isn't it?
The young man smiled.
Well, you're right. Just that process that you've been going through, Ethnarch Kerian, which you've been paying for this last year, which you did, if you remember, promise to pay for with more than just platinum. Do you remember?
I'm not sure.
The Ethnarch Kerian stalled. He could see the panel in the headboard where the gun was from the corner of his eye.
You promised to stop the killings in Uricam. Remember?
I may have said I'd review our segregation and resettlement policy in the...
No.
The young man waved his hand.
I mean the killings, Ethnarch. The death trains, remember? The trains where the exhaust comes out of the rear carriage eventually?
The young man made a sort of sneer with his mouth, shook his head.
Trigger any memories, that? No.
I have no idea what you're talking about,
the ethnarch said.
His palms were sweating, cold and slick. He rubbed them on the bedclothes. The gun mustn't slip if he got to it. The intruder's gun was still lying on the bed's footboard.
Oh, I think you do. In fact, I know you do.
If there have been any excesses by any members of the security forces, they will be thoroughly...
This isn't a press conference, ethnarch.
The man tipped slightly back in his seat, away from the gun on the footboard. The ethnarch tensed, quivering.
The point is, you made a deal and then didn't stick to it, and I'm here to collect on the penalty clause. You were warned, ethnarch. That which is given can also be taken away.
The intruder tipped further back in his seat, glanced round the dark suite, and nodded at the ethnarch while putting his hands clasped behind his head.
Say goodbye to all this, ethnarch Kerian. You're...
The ethnarch turned, banged the hidden panel with his elbow, and the section of headboard flicked round. He tore the gun from its clips and swung it at the man, finding the trigger and pulling. Nothing happened. The young man was watching him, hands still behind his neck, body rocking slowly back and forward in the chair. The ethnarch clicked the trigger a few more times.
Works better with these, the man said,
reaching into a shirt pocket and throwing a dozen bullets onto the bed at the ethnarch's feet. The gleaming bullets snicked as they rolled and gathered in a fold in the bedclothes. The ethnarch Kerian stared at them.
I'll give you anything, he said,
over a thick and dry tongue. He sensed his bowels start to relax and squeezed desperately, feeling suddenly like a child again, as though the retro-aging had taken him even further back.
Anything. Anything. I can give you more than you ever dreamed of. I can...
Not interested in that,
the man said, shaking his head. The story isn't finished yet. You see, these people, these nice, kind people who are so soft and prefer to deal in life, when somebody goes back on a deal with them, even when somebody kills after they've said they wouldn't, they still don't like to kill in return. They'd rather use their magic and their precious compassion to do the next best thing. And so, people disappear. The man sat forward again, leaning on the footboard. The ethnarch stared, shaking at him. They, these nice people, they disappear bad people, the young man said. And they employ people to come and collect these bad men and take them away. And these people, these collectors, they like to put the fear of death into their collectees, and they tend to dress... He gestured at his own colourfully motley clothes. Casually. And, of course, thanks to the magic, they never have any problems getting into even the most heavily guarded palace. The ethnarch swallowed, and with one furiously shaking hand, finally put down the useless gun he was holding.
Wait,
he said, trying to control his voice. His sweat soaked the sheets.
Are you saying we're nearly at the end of the story? The young man interrupted. These nice people, who you would call soft, like I say, they remove the bad people and they take them away. They put them somewhere they can't do any harm. Not a paradise, but not somewhere that feels like a prison either. And these bad people, they might have to listen sometimes to the nice people telling them how bad they've been. And they never again get the chance to change histories. But they live a comfortable, safe life, and they die peacefully, thanks to the nice people. And though some would say the nice people are too soft, the soft, nice people would say that the crimes committed by the bad people are usually so terrible, there is no known way of making the bad people start to suffer even a millionth of the agony and despair they have produced. So what is the point in retribution? It would be just another obscenity to cap the tyrant's life.